The Summit County Council got its first look at the proposed Hoytsville overlay yesterday. On the phone with a recap of yesterday's meeting, I have Summit County Council member Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
So regarding the Hoytsville overlay, some of the comments, of course, driven by nearby landowners, I guess concerned about the others who want to develop their land. You said that before you vote to approve it, you have to check a number of boxes. What are those boxes?
Well, just stepping back sort of broadly, this is a rezone project, right? So it is a highly discretionary process by which the council has to look at the zoning and balance our primary objectives and goals, which are health, safety, and welfare. Now, we do have our own list of what our objectives are, and they include things like environmental stewardship and water quality and traffic reduction and improvements to transportation and affordable housing. Those are sort of, that's our sort of our top 10 list. And so what I was telling those people or trying to explain to the audience is that this process is not one by which the landowner just gets to come in and say, I want to do the thing that's going to make me the most money. They have to come in and say, this is a good and balanced plan that provides community benefit while at the same time reflects good land use.
Yeah, so this overlay area, does it address all of the other need, water, sewer, infrastructure, traffic?
Oh, I think it touches on all of those issues. It's right adjacent. The Hoytsville, this overlay area is right adjacent to Colville, and sits right up tight against, in some cases, right up tight against the freeway there. And everybody knows we have a lot of wetlands right down by the freeway, and the Weber River runs right through there. So all of the areas that are of concern for us, in some respects, are probably within this geographical location.
So what are we? What's the zone change from rural residential to what?
Well, that's part of the process. And again, sort of stepping back and taking a broad look at this, we're involved in essentially what is a highly unique process where we're letting the existing landowners gather up a group and propose a master plan that would involve a variety of different individual properties. And it's going to present some huge challenges for them. They need to be able to understand that if they're going to get the rezone that they want, they have to figure out how to present enough community benefits to the council to do that rezone. Now, what that rezone is, we don't know yet, because all we have done is define a geographical area in which we've said, okay, go out and come back with the best master plan that you can for that area. It may involve things such as high density development. Undoubtedly there'll be an affordable housing component to it. There'll be a lot of land uses there that are not otherwise covered by our existing zoning. Our existing zoning primarily is just simply almost always about rural residential single-family dwellings.
So what we're at, though, is it what, one unit per 20 or one unit per 40 acres to a density of 2 be determined? Is that accurate?
That's correct, yeah. And we would expect, we would expect, this is about 1,000 acres or 1,100 acres, as I recall. We would expect a continuum of uses, everything from protection of critical lands and open space to single-family dwellings to perhaps even apartment complexes.
Is the debate at all affected by the attempt last year to make Hoytsville a town?
No, while some of the motivation of the landowners may be the same, I don't think that this in any way is a response to that. We put this process into place when we revised the zoning, which is now about, I believe, about 2 years old. So that predated the attempt of Hoyttsville to incorporate. And they're really very separate items. And that was actually one of the confusions, I think, among the public last night.
All right. How does this process compare to the Kimball Junction master plan?
Well, you know, there are certainly some similarities there. In the Kimball Junction master plan, we put together a committee that involved both people from staff, people from the planning department, engineering services, transportation, et cetera, along with existing residents, along with people who brought other expertise to the process. We put a committee together, and they spent a little less than 2 years looking at the Kimball Junction, looking at the remaining density that is to be built there, and then coming up with a concept that said, hey, perhaps there's a better way that we can move Kimball Junction to its completion. And so this is not dissimilar. Again, once that plan is developed, that plan has to go to the Planning Commission because it is essentially a rezone. And then the Planning Commission has to review it and make recommendations to the County Council, and then the County Council has the full discretionary authority to grant the rezone and or to modify the rezone. In Kimball Junction, we're doing a general plan update, which is not involving a rezone. General plan update is just simply, the vision for the area. What it tells the citizens what you can expect in the way of what sort of projects will be entertained by the county. This one is potentially a direct rezone.
And then what's the timeline on this Hoyttsville overlay?
Timeline largely is unknown. We'd like to get through the work of the committee expeditiously because, of course, it needs the review of the Planning Commission and the County Council and public input in order to likely to massage what that committee came up with in terms of recommendations. We're not going to take what the committee comes up with necessarily at face value and say, yes, this is good. We're going to apply all the rigor and all the scrutiny that we would to their plan with any proposed rezone.
All right. Speaking of the Kimball master plan, you went to the open house Wednesday morning. What did you hear, and what was your reaction to it?
It was a good meeting. It was reasonably well attended. Open houses are always hard. It's always hard to find times that work for everybody. It's always hard to get the word out. It's always hard to stimulate people to come to those sort of events. But we had a pretty good cross section. They were mostly residents on the east side of Kimball Junction. Kimball Junction has an east and west side divided by 224. And so they were from, Foxwood and from New Park and some of the other developments in there. There were sort of two reactions. One was general satisfaction or even enthusiasm about what our master plan is identifying as key elements or important strategies or concerns about, how Kimball Junction moves forward. The other concern that we hear from the public often is they want to know precisely what is happening. They want to know, okay, you're going into Kimball Junction, you're going to do a master plan, perhaps, of this area. How big is the building going to be? Where is the building going to be? How many people are going to live there? How many cars are going to be there, et cetera? That is not what the general plan does. Their concerns are addressed once we get beyond the general plan and we start to entertain specific development plans. That's when we know whether what the uses are going to be. So the big thing about Kimball Junction is there's about 1.3 million square feet of undeveloped density out there. And this is an opportunity for us to look at that and say, is that, you know, as currently designed, is that the best use? Should we just let it go forward? Or should we consider other uses? And what the Kimball Junction Master Plan says is that, well, maybe we should be considering more mixed uses. Maybe we should be making the west side of Kimball Junction, which is where Skull Candy is, maybe that should end up looking a little more like the east side of Kimball Junction.
Okay. Take a look at some of the other items on the agenda during public comment. A high school student, once again, asking you to install a plastic bag ban. This time, even adding that plastic waste from the landfill would affect the Rockport Reservoir. So what's the council's reaction to this?
Well, first of all, we're concerned with all things having to do with water quality. And there was a little bit of a misnomer that was stated by the gentleman who spoke last night. I think he indicated that contaminated water from the dump was flowing into Rockport. That is not the case. We monitor the groundwater out there. We do not have a problem with leachate from the dump going into Rockport. Now, is that a concern? Absolutely, it's a concern. You know, we're it's our responsibility to make sure that the dump is not leaching. So that aside, how do we feel about plastic bag bans? We're talking about that. We're dealing with the issue of how we deal with plastic, how we deal with refuge, how we deal with recycling. And yes, I expect it to be a topic that the council will engage on shortly.
Okay. You also had a report regarding the Echo and Rockport State Parks. Everything good there?
Generally, what we're seeing is that the state park system is putting a little more time, energy, and money into those facilities. There are a couple of different things that are going on there. In Rockport, they're just doing some upgrades. They're improving some bathroom facilities. A few things like that. In Echo, they're doing a complete redo of the camping facility there. So those projects are underway. They're also doing rail trail improvements and repair and maintenance on the rail trail. Those things, of course, are near and dear to our heart as well. So we're pleased with what the state is doing.
All right. Also, the resolution for a tax levy for North Summit Recreation District. Did the council approve the resolution to get this process started?
We're very supportive of the resolution. The resolution will be approved probably in about 2 months. It was set up for approval, but does not need to be approved until I believe it's roughly 90 days before the election. And the reason why we didn't approve it is because once we approve the resolution, we can then no longer advocate for it. And we are advocates for it. We are in step with North Summit Rec, and sincerely hope that this bond goes through. It's a major It's an issue of considerable importance for North Summit. North Summit Rec is the only district or entity of its kind that is still receiving supplements from the county that is otherwise not either providing or getting the revenue from the tax base, like for example, like Basin Rec does. You know, we pay taxes to Basin Rec. So it's time for the citizens of North Summit to step up and say, yes, we value the recreation that is being provided by North Summit Recreation for our children.
Okay, finally, I just wanted to ask you about the bypass road for Blue Sky Ranch, a long discussion, no decision yet at this point.
Yeah, it was sort of a complicated and a little bit messy application, and you know, as a council in the county, we have a thing called a special exception permit, and the special exception permit is the sort of last resort of how do you solve things that are projects that, you know, may have merit, but they don't comply strictly with the code. We try and do our best to avoid special exceptions. And one of the things that we found when we were looking at the Blue Sky special exception request was that we were not convinced that it was necessarily well thought out or providing the best alternative. So we gave them some direction, which we think hopefully will make it a better alternative. And I think that we're inclined to get it done. They're an important part of the economy out there. They've invested a lot of money. We want to make them successful, but at the same time, we need to protect the integrity of our processes.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Doug, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
Summit County Councilmember Doug Clyde. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, as we've reported, it was a record year for skier visits in the state of Utah. Part of that, of course, had to do with record numbers at Deer Valley. In the studio to tell us how things went this season at Park City Mountain, I have Marketing Director Emily Curtis. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So does the country's largest resort do the largest number of skier days?
First, I think thanks for having me on the show, Leslie. You know, I'm new to the community, so I just wanted to take a moment to introduce myself. I just moved to the community about 9 months ago. I was previously in Beaver Creek, worked for Vail Resorts for about 16 years, and was thrilled to be able to come to Park City. I've been on skis since I was 3 years old, and my parents raised me skiing on the East Coast and was excited to be able to come here and sort of share my passion for the ski industry. And it certainly was a great season at Park City Mountain, as well as for the state of Utah. So it was really exciting to see those numbers come out from Ski Utah yesterday, where we're seeing such great skier visitation to the state. And at Park City, you know, we had a wonderful year. We had 400 inches of snow at the Jupiter Snowstake, which was significantly more than we had last year, and certainly above the seasonal average of 355 inches. So we were really excited for the season we had. We had really consistent snowfall throughout the season that really allowed us to provide a wonderful guest experience and a really consistent snow service for our guests.
Yeah. So again, Deer Valley reporting double-digit increases this season. I mean, could you say the same for Park City Mountain?
You know, we typically don't report on specific business metrics, but overall was a great year for Park City Mountain, and we were just really thrilled with the snow and the conditions we were able to provide for our guests.
And so what about the other side of things besides skier days and lessons, lodging, food sales, that also?
Yeah, just a great year. You know, as you know, we rolled out some really cool capital projects this year. I think you had a chance to go up to Mid Mountain Lodge, and what an incredible experience we were able to provide for our guests up there. We, you know, refurbished the inside of that. We put in a full service bar, which, you know, in the state of Utah is something really unique and different. And our guests just really resonated with the experience that we provided up there. The craft cocktails, the incredible deck. You know, in the spring we had DJs up there, and people were able to just enjoy that great deck and the sun. The fresh food that we offered was really incredible. So yeah, Mid Mountain Lodge was a real hit with our guests. As well as Cloud Dine. We expanded that area, that we expanded that restaurant up at the top of Dream Peak. We know that our guests love to ski that area of the mountain. And, you know, we were able to expand that to 200 seats to accommodate more people, give a little bit more elbow room. You know, our chefs up there are known for their fresh dough. So the fresh pizzas and the salad were just a really big hit with our guests. So certainly, you know, overall, just a great season. And we were really happy with what happened at Park City this year.
Yeah, and you're certainly, I'm sure, aware of just all of the public complaints about the resort closing a week earlier than it usually does. I mean, it tends to stay open a week later at least than from Deer Valley, sometimes more. So how come? I mean, we heard, we know it wasn't a lack of snow. We heard it was employees.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it's important, I think, for your listeners to know that we stuck with our original closing date. You know, we set those closing dates early on. That April 7th closing date was announced last May. And so, you know, we made that decision to stick with that closing date. What we typically see is, you know, as the weather starts to warm up, people start to think about other activities. They're heading to Moab, they're getting on their bikes. And so, you know, we had a wonderful year. We had a great year. I know I certainly enjoyed it. It was my first time skiing Park City Mountain. I was so impressed with the terrain and the snow. And I really tried to take advantage of every single powder day that happened. And so, we decided to stick with that closing date. And we're looking forward to next season and hoping we have another great snow year.
Okay, well then let's talk. What are the opening and closing dates then for 1920?
Yeah, so we typically announce those in the late spring, early summer. So more to come. So stay tuned on that.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the capital improvements you have at the resort for this summer. You announced yesterday a new chairlift, but
yeah.
It's not about skiing, huh?
Yeah. So the new chairlift is going to be called Over and Out. And really, the purpose of that chairlift was in response to the guest feedback that we heard about egress out of the Tombstone area. So, you know, guests that are out enjoying Dream Peak and Iron Mountain, guests that are, you know, have maybe worked their way over to Park City Mountain or trying to get back to Canyons Village at the end of the day, this is really going to be a game changer for them. They're really going to be able to get off the mountain faster. And so the lift will be an egress from the bottom of Tombstone Lift to the top of Sunrise. And then guests will be able to, you know, quickly ski down to Canyons Village from there. So really shortening the return time back to Canyons Village at the end of the day for those guests staying in Canyons Village.
Yeah. Confusion, though, whether or not it can also be an access. It's only at, why not do it both ways?
Yeah. I mean, the really great thing about capital improvements and how we select the capital improvements that we're going to do at Park City Mountain is we really listen to our guests and we really listen to the feedback that they give us. And this was the feedback that we received was, you know, they just wanted to be able to get back to Canyons Village in an easier, faster manner at the end of the day. So this is really going to be able to provide that for our guests.
Oh, I think people standing at the base of Orange Bubble Express or the gondola would say they'd like another way up the mountain, and that could provide it, right? Going up Sunrise, and if you had allowed that to go up to Tombstone, then the Over and Out.
Yeah, I mean, again, this was the guest feedback that we heard, and you know, we're excited to be able to provide this for our guests and be able to get people back to Canyons Village faster by the end of the day.
Okay, but it could be. I mean, you could build it both ways. No, I mean, we see that with other chairlifts, certainly.
Yeah, like I mentioned, you know, every year when we think about the capital improvements that we're going to do at Park City, we really look at the. We look at what our guests are telling us. So, you know, certainly there's more capital improvements in the future. We also have the Tombstone permanent structure going in this summer. So Tombstone, which everybody, you know, I know all your listeners love the barbecue at Tombstone. We're going to be making that a permanent structure this summer, which will include 50 seats. So guests will be able to enjoy the barbecue any time of the season, whether it's cold outside or warm outside, they'll be able to enjoy that area. So a lot of really exciting things coming to Park City this coming winter.
Okay. Any other capital improvements that you wanted to mention?
You know, I also just wanted to make sure we mentioned that we are opening for summer on Saturday. We had originally planned to open tomorrow. As we look out the window, we know that the weather has been a little uncooperative this week. So we're just letting things dry out, and we just want to make sure we provide the best guest experience that we can. So we'll be opening the Adventure Park on Saturday, as well as Canyons Golf.
Okay. Anything new there once the full season gets underway?
For summer, we'll have, we'll just have the adventure park as we did last year with the coaster and the Alpine slide. We're working with Mountain Trails Foundation as to when we'll open up the mountain biking. We really just want to make sure that the trails are dried out before we offer our bike hall passes.
Okay. And then Farmer's Market, does that come back to the lower parking lot?
It does. Yep. So Farmer's Market will be back for another summer, as well as a bunch of other great activities and events that we'll have going on. We'll have the summer concert series in Canyons Village again on Thursday and Saturday nights. We'll have the July 3rd event in Canyons Village, which will include live music and fireworks. And then obviously, in conjunction with the city, we'll have the July 4th event at Park City Mountain Village. So guests and your listeners can go out and enjoy the parade. And then we'll have live music there, as well as capping the evening off with fireworks as well.
Yeah, so we brought the farmers market over to the base of Park City just due to a lot of construction happening there at the base of Canyons Village. Mm-hmm. Where do things stand with the workforce housing there at the base of the Cabriolet?
Yeah, so the Canyons Village Management Association recently selected a developer. So they'll be beginning construction on workforce housing at the base of Canyons. It will include 1,100 beds. And so Park City Mountain employees will have access to those beds.
Okay. And of course, we had reported earlier this year that Vail Resorts had sold the developable parking lots there at the base of Park City. Mm-hmm. You guys are certainly, though, part of that, you being Vail Resorts. Where do things stand with that?
Yeah, so we announced about a month ago that we sold that land to PEG, which is a Utah developer. Vail Resorts several years ago got out of the real estate business, and so we've sold that land to them, and we will be looking forward to them partnering with the community on what that build out will look like. What we do know is that it will include a hotel, a spa. It will include workforce housing. It will include parking structures, really improve traffic flow and parking for that area. And so we expect PEG will be reaching out, over the coming weeks and months to collaborate with the community on what that project's going to look like.
Okay. Emily, anything else you want to mention?
Just wanted to make sure we mention that season passes for next winter. We have a deadline coming up on Monday. So $49 down. Prices will go up. So make sure if you're interested in getting an Epic Pass for next year that you do that by Monday.
Okay. Emily Curtis is the marketing director with Park City Mountain. Thanks. Great. For your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, time's running out to let the Summit County Health Department know what's important to you. The window for filling out this year's community healthy assessment comes to a close to a week from tomorrow. That's May 31st. In the studio with details, I have Summit County Environmental Health Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning.
So at one point you were hoping for 750 responses. Where are we at now?
This morning, we just checked it, and we hit about that 575 mark. So we're about 175 short of our goal. But we feel that confident with radio interviews like this and some of the things that we're doing on social media that we'll hit that come a week from tomorrow.
Well, let's talk first maybe just about how you're encouraging people to fill this out, bribing them a little bit with some gift cards.
Yeah, definitely. As we've talked about in the past, people are a little bit immune to some of the surveys, as there's a number of them going out, especially this time of year, for a variety of reasons. And so as an incentive for taking 10 to 15 minutes out of your day to fill out our community health assessment, we have Amazon gift cards. We just reached our last benchmark of 500 responses. So today, Derek Sidaway, our PIO, and I will be doing a giveaway live on Facebook. So that's scheduled for directly after we finish this interview today.
Okay. And then there's one more opportunity then to win something? Is that...
Yeah,
you hit a benchmark.
If we hit the next benchmark, we have a big giveaway of a $100 gift card to Amazon for everybody that's taken the survey that hasn't won up to that point.
Okay. So tell us a little again why you're doing this and what kind of information you're looking for.
Sure. This is a suggested exercise by the National Association of City and County Health Officials that a community health assessment be done every 5 to 7 years. We've hit that 5 to 7 year benchmark for a general public health community health assessment. This is different than the mental health assessment that was done in 2016. So we're diving in. We want to see where we've improved, where we can improve, things that we can do better based on the previous one that was completed in 2012, and get an idea of what was important then, but what also is important now to the individuals that are living and working in our community.
Yeah. So have you had a chance to look at some of the results that have already come in?
We have, yeah. We've been evaluating them as they've come in just to kind of stay on top of things, make sure that the messaging that we send out is appropriate for those individuals that we might be missing, or if we're seeing some common trends coming in, we can start maybe a little bit of research on our end based on what we're seeing.
Okay. Anything stand out for you?
Yeah, we have a few stats that are pretty interesting. Right now, for every 4 surveys we take or that we're seeing coming in, 3 are female and 1 is male. So as a male, I'm encouraging all of my fellow guys out there to step up, take this survey, chance to win an Amazon gift card, but let's hear what's important to you. As guys in the community, of course, we definitely still want to hear from the gals and females in our community that are interested in participating. We want to hear from everybody, but that 3-to-1 ratio is pretty interesting to us. The second is that for every 2 surveys that we get out of the Snyderville Basin or Park City Municipal Area, we're getting 1 on our east side of our community. And so we're really encouraging those in our east side to take the survey, let us hear what's important to you on the east side so that we're understanding both sides of our community, and we can make sure that when the discussion about resources and efforts are had by the Board of Health and the County Council, that it's a fair shake for everybody, that everybody's voice has been heard, and that all of the opinions and different insights have been included in this survey. And one of the bigger concerns that we have, despite our efforts, is that for every 4 surveys that are completed in English, we're getting 1 in Spanish. And so we want to make sure that our Hispanic community and those Spanish-speaking individuals are also being offered this survey. Most of the ones that we've received in Spanish are done in person on hard copies, and that's great. We have our some of the interns at the health department and our Spanish-speaking interpreters will be entering those into the SurveyMonkey so that that information is all electronic. But whether it's in paper, on your phone, on a computer, wherever you do it, we encourage everybody to take the survey, but we really want to hear from our Spanish-speaking residents.
Yeah, I was going to say, though, that that's probably about balanced in terms of population. I mean, because we've got about a 20% Latino population, so that kind of translates 1-to-4, yeah?
Right, and that's, you know, that's accurate, of course, but we do definitely want to see more of those Spanish-speaking completed surveys. It just provides a little bit more in-depth and a little bit different and unique perspective on public health matters in our community.
Okay. Are the questions then, is it that they're all open-ended or are they multiple choice, or you said 10 to 15 minutes?
Yeah, the first few questions are all multiple choice. They're general demographic questions about zip code and that, so we can kind of see where we're getting our surveys from. But the back end, the last, I think, 9 questions are all open-ended, fill-in-the-blank sort of questions. And some of them are very interesting topics, and others are things that we've heard before. The things that we're hearing that are extremely interesting are all surrounded around our messaging. A lot of them are programs that we're already doing, but apparently the community is not aware that these services are offered by the health department. Things like, you know, help with the programs such as immunizations and those things. Everybody understands that the health department does food inspections and that they provide immunizations. But I don't think the community generally understands the depth in which we're providing these services. So it's been interesting. A lot of surveys have come in talking about empowering youth and providing them with tools to deal with drugs, peer pressure, a lot of these things that have been endemic public health issues since the test of time. So we're hearing those things, but most of the surveys are around messaging, and we're continuing to not tell our story well enough that people can really leverage those assets that we have at the health department.
Okay. So the results, though, I mean, basically it determines where money gets spent, right? So it's important.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is going to be the driving document for both the Board of Health and our County Council in allocating resources in the coming years, the next 5 years, and how public health really is administered in our county. So it's a very important process. It's a responsible process, and it's the process that's going to create social change in a responsible way.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Phil? We should tell people where it is.
Yeah, we can do that. Head to the summitcountyhealth.org website. You can find it on our Facebook page. You can come into any of our 3 locations in Camas, Colville, or Park City. Take it in person. Just ask one of our lovely front-end administrators there for a hard copy, and they'll be able to provide that for you. And stay tuned later today on our Facebook page for a live giveaway of those gift cards from reaching that 500 survey response benchmark.
Okay. Hey, Phil, thanks for coming in.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Summit County Environmental Health Director Phil Bondurant. Well, Park City High School's marching band is the only Utah group that will be performing in Normandy, France at the D-Day 75th anniversary. In the studio to tell us more about that, I have Assistant Park City High School Band Director Brett Hughes. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. Glad to talk about this. So this was an invite then to the district?
Yeah, so this was definitely an invitation. The event actually is based on application normally, but we were invited to perform at it based on our performance and our students' professionalism and stuff like that when we were in Pearl Harbor in 2016. So the same group that produced the Pearl Harbor commemorations produces the D-Day commemorations as well. And they reached out to us actually about 3 weeks after we got back from Pearl Harbor that Christmas and said, we want you to come to Pearl Harbor again. And we said, we can't go to Pearl Harbor again. Like financially, we can't go. Right? We just can't do that right now. And they said, great. How about Washington, D.C. for the Memorial Day Parade? And we're like, we're just not ready to travel. We need some time. And so they said, okay, no big deal. And they called us back a couple of weeks later and said, how about Normandy for the 75th D-Day? And we're like, we could probably work that one out. And so we had not intended on traveling this year. We had planned on waiting another couple of years because trips like this they're a monster to plan. They're expensive to execute. And so we had planned on waiting a little while. And we talked with Bob O'Connor, who was the principal at Park City High School at the time, and Ember Conley is the superintendent at the time, and said, here's the offer that's on the table. And both of them said, you would be stupid not to take it. And so we decided, okay, we're going to do it. And so we've known since about February of 2017 that this was coming.
All right. So you've had like 2 years then to plan and raise money so that all of the kids can come. How many kids are going?
We're taking 77 kids. And, you know, we've raised money. We've worked hard. The financial burden still does fall on the families to a certain extent. But we've worked really hard to make sure that any student who wants to go, who does have a financial concern, we've worked to find donors for them, or we've used fundraising money for them to help offset that cost. And so, yeah, every student who's approached us that wanted to go, we've been able to help find a way to go.
Okay. So, do you still need some money?
Always. Like, you know, right now we've paid off the actual trip itself, but we still are getting ready to incur luggage costs. And, you know, gratuities for bus drivers and things like that. And so there's always costs that pop up. So, yeah, donations are always welcome at all times.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah. What does it cost to ship a drum over there?
You know, we'll check them as luggage on the plane. And so they get charged oversized and overweight baggage fees. So it depends on what kind of day the gate agent or the baggage agent is having. And it could be anywhere from $50 to $200, just... kind of depends. When we went to Hawaii, we spent about $8,000 on luggage costs to get all the instruments and all the luggage to Hawaii and back.
Yeah, because you've got big hats too, right?
Right. And luckily, though, you know, the feathers come out of the hats. The hats can go on the plane. That's not as big of an issue. It's the drums and the tubas and the color guard flags and things like that that have to get checked.
All right. So you, this is happening. It's like a 3-day deal then in June?
So we'll be in Europe. Most of us will be there for 10 days. The rest of the group will be there for 7 days. But the actual commemoration is, 3 days. It's June 6th, 7th, and 8th in the Normandy region. And that includes we're performing at the American Cemetery at Brittany on June 6th. And we're performing at the American Normandy Cemetery on June 7th. And then the official commemoration activities are on June 8th this year, being the Saturday. And those take place in a small little town, and there's a parade, and there's town square performances, and things like that. So, 3 days in the Normandy region where we'll be able to play each of those 3 days.
And what are you going to be performing? It's same thing every day or something different each time?
So a little bit different each time. The actual commemoration on June 8th, we chose to go with a little bit more like pop-based music and dance music. We learned from our tour guides that the community in St. Margulies really enjoy American music, and they really enjoy the Americans when we're over there at D-Day. And they told us, you know, there'll be a lot of bands that play patriotic music and Americana music, and that you don't really, everybody's going to do that. So do something different. And so for that performance, our town square performance and our parade, we're going to take more of a pop and rock approach and play, you know, tunes people are going to recognize. We're going to play Hey Pachuco and Sir Duke and some of the best hits we've played on the 4th of July parades here over the last 10 years. The two performances at the cemeteries, those actually have a mass band performance. There's 13 bands going from the states, and it's kind of headed up by the University of Texas Longhorn Band. That's their band plus some alumni members of their band. It's about a 350-person band. They're kind of the lead group at the cemeteries, and their band director received permission from John Williams to write a marching band arrangement of Hymn to the Fallen, which is one of the theme songs from Saving Private Ryan. And it's the song that plays as the soundtrack in Saving Private Ryan when they're visiting the Normandy Cemetery. And so John Williams gave permission for Dr. Hannah to arrange that tune for all the bands who are coming to play as a mass band at the two cemetery performances. And so the two cemetery performances, we'll play that, and then the New York Police Department Pipes and Drums Corps will be there, and they're going to play, and the Sound of the Rockies Men's Chorus is going to sing. And so those are obviously a little bit more reverent ceremonies, and we won't play necessarily anything on our own at those, but we'll be part of that 1,500-member mass band who will perform at those two events.
So it sounds like you get to stay just a little bit longer and do some traveling.
Yeah, so then we're in Normandy through the 8th, and then the night of the 8th we transfer to Paris, and we're in Paris until the morning of the 11th. And we'll do a little bit more sightseeing and tourist stuff in Paris. We do actually have a performance in Paris, the park that sits right next to the Eiffel Tower. We're going to perform in on Monday, June 10th, and do, again, some of the more pop and rock stuff, just a little bit more crowd-pleasing, have some fun style performance. And then on the 11th, about half the group comes home, and the other half of us get on the Eurostar, and we're spending 3 days in London just as tourists. It was just an optional add-on for, hey, you're already going to be over there. You already paid for airfare. If you want to spend a few more days over here, let's go to London.
Okay. So, real quick, what kind of impact did performing there at the Pearl Harbor commemoration have on kids? Because expecting a similar impact.
Oh, yeah. Well,
here.
And I would imagine probably even deeper in Normandy. But, prior to going to Pearl Harbor, all of our students, we know about Pearl Harbor. We know the story of Pearl Harbor. And the first day we were in Hawaii, we actually performed on the dock right next to the USS Missouri. And that overlooks the USS Arizona Memorial. And as the band marched in to perform next to the USS Missouri, the kids will tell you that they had a kind of an epiphany of, oh, wow, okay. And they started to understand the weight that was Pearl Harbor and what that meant. And so that was the first day we were there. And over the next 3 days leading up to the actual Pearl Harbor anniversary, the kids met a lot of surviving veterans and who are all now in their 90s. And they met a lot of people who have been in Hawaii for a long time and started to really understand the impact. And they started seeing local publications that had, stories of Pearl Harbor. And when they came back a week later, they would tell you, oh yeah, no, that was a totally different experience than we were expecting. And they had a totally different appreciation for it. And, being the last, probably the last major anniversary of D-Day that there will be surviving veterans at. Like, I imagine it's going to leave a huge impact on the students.
Well, congratulations. That's very impressive that you guys get to go. Thanks
for
coming
in
this morning.
Thanks.
Brett Hughes, again, the Assistant Director for Park City High School's Marching Band. KPCW, Park City. Time for news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. American farmers caught up in the midst of the trade war with China are set to get a big boost from the federal government. NPR's Amy Held reports President Trump plans to announce the latest farm bailout today.
Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue says part of the new $16 billion farm aid package will go toward market access so American farmers can sell their goods outside of China. Perdue spoke to Fox Business Network.
China's going to pay for this $16 billion through tariffs coming in.
Earlier this month, the U.S. announced it was upping tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. China retaliated with its own tariff increase on $60 billion of U.S. goods. And American farmers who rely on foreign markets to buy their corn, soybeans, and pork are feeling the impact. The Farm Belt runs through key swing states, a constituency President Trump does not want to lose in the 2020 election. Amy Held, NPR News, Washington.